know, we've talked about what some people describe the crisis in masculinity, and we're not hearing about the good news about, you know, compassionate men and men who are wanting to change. But if we want to see men change, and if we want to have a culture that's really inviting that change, then we have to be honest and open to identify situations where the danger is so acute and the lack of identification of what's going on is so understated.
Hello, my name is Clay Boykin, and I'm in search of the new compassionate male. Today, I had the opportunity to have a conversation with Rob Okun. Rob is the editor and publisher of Voicemail Magazine. That's male spelled M-A-L-E. He's also the former executive director of the Men's Resource Center for Change. That's one of the earliest men's centers in North America. Rob has a book. The title is Voicemail: The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Movement. In it, he talks about one of the most important social justice movements most people have never heard of, the anti-sexist men's movement. Let's join that conversation.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and we are in search of the new compassionate male. I'm the co-host of this podcast, and I'm here with the founder, Clay Boykin. Hello, Clay.
Hello, Dennis. Boy, am I excited about this afternoon. Rob Okun is with us, and Rob has been deeply involved, and that's an understatement, with with men's work at all different levels. And I wish we had 5 hours to talk, but we only have about 50 minutes.
Well, let's give this a start, and we'll be going. Rob, welcome. Welcome to the podcast.
Delighted to be here and to meet you both.
Well, it is, you know, we have been in search of the new compassionate male because we've been looking. We know that our role, especially our role as older white men, we have and who are still in power, who still have 80% of all of the political and the economic influence, that it is our role. We have to come to the table. And you specifically have talked about in all of your writing and all of your advocacy about the role of the male in the feminist, in the pro-feminist movement. Do I have that understanding? And just exactly, I want to explore that today.
Sure. That's a fair summary. If you want me to pick up from that, I can.
That's exactly where I pick up and dig deep.
Okay. Well, it's true that there's been this tension all along over the years between feminism and men. And to me, it's a false flag because the benefits of feminism are about equality for everyone. So, you know, just to put that aside at the outset, that men who feel threatened by feminism aren't really understanding what it is. And the unfair advantages that we have had just by the, you know, the chance that we arrived on the planet in male-identified bodies doesn't mean that we're ruling the roost. Even as you say that this moment that we're in, where it feels to a lot of men that the, you know, nature-given, God-given power to be in charge is somehow being threatened, as opposed to recognizing that it's been an unfair situation. It's been an imbalanced playing field, an unlevel playing field, and now we're at a moment where if men can get out of our own way, and when I say that, I mean our grasping onto what was, yes, or our fear of what could be, if we can find that middle ground, you know, in our own hearts between trusting that what's ahead is healthy and helpful for us as male-identified people, but that there's a richness to having the input and the experience and the voice of women, you know, in all conversations and in all walks of life. And we're having this conversation on a day when the first African-American woman is being nominated to be an associate justice on the Supreme Court. So I just want to put out for men who are listening to this who might be skeptical or just feeling a little tightness around someone who's identifying himself as pro-feminist. We can talk about why I say that versus just feminist. That get comfortable with the idea that equality is something that we're all entitled to, and that feminism is simply the proposition that women and men and anyone else, however they describe themselves or define themselves, should have equal opportunities, equal benefits in our society.
I was one of the things that Clay, you know, you and I have talked about on many times is that it appears to us as if the world has gone to a level of complexity that requires that before, in the before times, that it was there was a simple enough system that the patriarchal system might work to get us in certain places. But now the world is so complex and interdependent that we need the combination of all thoughts, the population at all thoughts and perspectives in order to succeed. It's a synergistic rather than a zero-sum game. Does that resonate with your experience?
Yes, of course. And, you know, I grew up, you know, in the 50s and 60s and was socialized, you know, to the ideas and the expectations of maleness in those times. And it was only my experiences going through the, you know, primarily the anti-war movement, but certainly the beginnings of the environmental movement, Earth Day and, you know, in 1970, and the gay rights movement and the women's movement, that informed how I was identifying with my maleness. And I feel fortunate that I came of age when I did, because I hadn't hardened my views so that I was not suspicious of women in the women's movement or suspicious of gay rights movement. I was just kind of a young guy trying to figure it all out, and I was open. And I think that one of the things that I reflected on many years later in a chapter I wrote for a book called Confessions of a Premature Pro-Feminist, which was a takeoff on the premature anti-fascist from the 30s, the people that went to fight for the against Franco in the Spanish Civil War.
Yes.
Who our State Department described as, you know, premature anti-fascists, and then who they turned to become involved in the Second World War with their leadership. But I digress. I think that one of the things that occurred to me when I thought about those days in my late teens, early 20s, was that I'd be at these anti-war meetings, and they were run by the stereotypical mustachioed, more macho-oriented guys whose politics on the war were great, whose politics on gender was just tone-deaf to everything. And as I thought about it when I was writing, you know, 40 years later, women were making the most cogent points in these meetings and yet didn't hold leadership positions. That wasn't entirely the case. There was, you know, moments and people and places, but by and large, it was a male dominated. And that was one of the downfalls of the New Left. And of course, it was women in the New Left who threw up their hands when they recognized just how resistant and sexist these men were, and that gave rise to the women's movement. And I think that it's that nexus of recognizing women's leadership, women stepping away from the movement that they were in and creating their own movement, that gave some men pause. Some men resisted, said, you know, I'm done. And other men said, what's that about? And I think for those of us who had even a little bit of curiosity, you know, we were the kinder, gentler sexists. And I'm sure that if I could, you know, be in touch with some of the women that I knew in my undergraduate days, that I would have some embarrassing moments. But it was that recognition that there's something going on here, that consciousness raising groups and recognizing that there's this relationship between the personal and the political, that was just exciting. It was confusing for sure. And I certainly, like a lot of men who became involved in pro-feminist men's work, certainly there was some trepidation. But I think the hunger for what was going on over there, and I think more than just, you know, being sort of envious of it, that camaraderie and that sisterhood and the politics and everything was so sparking. But I think there was in my heart of hearts, it was this recognition that this is right, and what was happening before was wrong. And it's hard to unsee the truth once you've seen it.
Well, you talked about trust. You talked a lot. You've talked about both of us had a lot of trust issues with men. Would you talk about that, Clay? And I'd love to hear Rob's take.
Yeah. Well, and this has been my feeling, and it's been over the past 10 years in the men's work that I've done. That seems to be a kind of a common theme, that so many men have either gone through their dark night of the soul, or they're coming up through a recovery program or something, and they're looking for something a little bit more, I'll say, spiritual, but they don't differentiate between spirituality and religion. And they say, well, I got burned on organized religion, so I'm not going to go there. And they can speak to their spouse or partner to a certain level, but it's only when they can connect with another man at a deep level that there's some things that they can only learn there. But we're raised not to trust one another. And so that, for me personally, my experience was that created this void in me and this gnawing. And the harder I worked outwardly, the more that this hurt inwardly. And I've run across so many men who say, oh yeah, I've got that feeling too. And it stems for me in not really having a strong male role model growing up, and finding situations where I couldn't trust men. And so that starts that spin. But I see a whole population out there of guys that are here, but they're stuck. They're stuck in their heart, or they're stuck. They don't have the vocabulary to speak or to express themselves, and they're confused about this. And, you know, we're festering inside and we're dying, or we're killing other people as a result.
Right. And I think what you're hitting on, and where the conversation in this organic fashion, we started with a little bit more of this social justice, social change, you know, political orientation towards understanding what we could do as men. And you're bringing us back to the key, important heart work that so many men have struggled with, or are struggling with, or don't have the vocabulary for. And it just reminds me of the blessing of connecting with the organization that I became deeply involved with for many years, one of the earliest men's centers in North America. It was called Men's Resource Center, and it was based in Western Massachusetts. And I like to say that I showed up, in using baseball terminology, in the bottom of the first or the top of the second inning. I wasn't a founder, but I was up close from pretty much the beginning. And the community where I live in Western Massachusetts has had a long history of integrating spiritual pursuits and social justice pursuits. That whatever tension there might have been about those areas in the 70s and into the early 80s began to become very integrated. So the tagline of the organization, the Men's Resource Center, was supporting men, challenging men's violence. So it was in the two wings of this bird of peace that we were trying to create. And I know that sometimes there were people who showed up who were taken aback and they couldn't quite connect with, you know, those seemingly disparate ideas. But once the conversation happened or the self-exploration happened and there was that aha moment, it was like, oh, of course, I have to do the inner work and I can't ignore the outer work. And, you know, it's really interesting when Robert Bly died recently, there was so much emphasis on his work, you know, particularly Iron Man and how he was perceived as this elder in the men's movement. And it really ignored his whole history as a political activist, very strong anti-war activist. And I always felt that it was too bad that even a paragraph or two in that book that said, you know, I'm focusing in on the inner work that men need to do, but this isn't the place that I want to talk about the outer work that men need to be engaged in. And I had the opportunity of meeting him in his later years, and we didn't have that direct conversation, but I felt like there was a sense of like appreciation for, I know what you guys are doing, meaning the Men's Center and the magazine that I edit. And I think that there was a lost opportunity in the 90s. And, you know, I'm sure that if one talked to Bill Moyers, who did that famous interview with Robert Bly, that there would have been, oh yeah, I probably should have talked about this piece. So I'm glad that we're having the chance to notice that the stuck place, the hurt place, it can actually be loosened and freed up by feeling that sense of purpose to take on injustice, and particularly gender inequality is a place where when men open up to it and don't feel resistant to it, that light bulb does really go on.
You know, so true. We had a gentleman named Howard Teich on, and I've gotten to know him pretty well. And in our conversation, at one point, he was talking about solar and lunar. He was speaking in that term, the solar male and the lunar female, and the fact that both genders, if you will, have both energies within them. And I was tracking along with that just fine. And then he said, now, Clay, you're an old Marine. Now tell me if this isn't true. The lunar leads and the solar executes. Well, Dennis saw me. I kind of jumped back a little bit. I thought, oh boy. But I thought about it, and it's true. In all my time in the Corps, it was heart. This is where leadership is born. And yes, and it's a combination, of course, but primarily it's from the heart, and we execute from the head. I can't think of a situation where we had to, you know, go into harm's way where someone was just leading from the neck up. And so to me, it's like, why can't guys understand this, that you're not complete just up here, that you've got to embrace here, that this is where true leadership comes from. It's from the heart. and you need to get there and learn. There's nothing soft about that.
I really like how you phrase that, Clay, because I want to ask you, Rob, the question of why. All right, because here we are as a culture. Here we are in 2022. All the three of us are in the fourth quarters of our lives in what we're doing and what we're... So where are the places where we can have impact in order to push this conversation forth and help change the world?
Yeah. Just a little question to ask.
Just a little one. I'm sorry. Yeah, I just tossed away a little.
Well, men's frozen spot, that place that we've been naming, that inability to open up and to look at our interior lives and to feel the struggle and to embrace it and to, you know, be vulnerable, all these things that most men have been socialized to be resistant to. We're at an inflection point where that's slowly shifting. And I think it's a great opportunity, and it's a sense of frustration that we haven't made the kind of progress that, you know, we might have. But I think you hit on something, like, there will probably be some people, when they hear the word compassion, or some people identify as male, okay, I'm not checking that out. You know, that the words have been gendered. So compassion is feminine, and courage is masculine. So when we think the word courage, we think of the firefighter rushing into the burning building and coming out with the baby. We don't necessarily think that it's a group of guys standing around and somebody makes a sexist or a racist, a homophobic joke. And rather than casting your eyes down or walking away, somebody says, hey man, I don't like that. I need you to stop talking that way. That's not cool. That's the kind of courage. So I think we've been stuck because men have felt that inability to speak up. And right now, I mean, this is a great point to dig into, because I think we are at a moment where we need our voices in the conversation. When I say our, it's, you know, whether it's men in, you say, the fourth quarter, I say the seventh inning.
Seventh inning. I'm sorry. We've got a Red Sox fan here, so we better make sure that Fenway is well represented.
You know, I'm referred to by my grandchildren as Big Poppy, which is David Ortiz's, the Red Sox, now Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that right now there is a potential army of men, maybe say from, you know, young fathers in their 30s up to guys in their seventh inning, who, if we can organize ourselves and find our voices, we can really contribute so much to every social problem that we're dealing with, you know, from climate crisis, you know, to, you know, democracy crisis, I mean, across the board. And it occurred to me after Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted for murdering two people and wounding another at the in Kenosha, Wisconsin, at the protests about Jacob Blake's being paralyzed, that he, at 18, became suddenly a star among the particular perspective from, you know, the right wing. And I'm thinking to myself, are there fathers and teachers and uncles and mentors who want to raise sons, regardless of what you think of the jury verdict or any of that? Do we want to have our 18, 17-year-old at the time, do we want them thinking that the way to express power and courage and manhood is to go with a, I don't know, what was it, an AK?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever he had, an assault rifle. Is that what we want? Because if we stay silent, then that is the message that millions of males are expressing through our silence, and I say even that makes us in collusion with that.
We're culpable.
You know,
it's just time that we use things like that as an example to say no more.
I agree. This is what so excited me, Rob, when you sent me the magazine's voicemail, and I started just quickly thumbing through and got tremendously excited because this is speaking to the younger men. And this has been an area where In Search of the New Compassionate Male has really, it's a wide audience, but it tends to be towards this, you know, entering into the second half of life. And so this has been a real
The
real
fifth
concern.
Inning, and it is. And so are you finding, Rob, are you finding that burning in the 20-year-olds and the young kids that are coming? I mean, I see it on the political front, but I'm not sure I see it in the men. I'm not experiencing it yet as much in the pro-feminist movement.
Yeah. Well, I want to say two things and then get into that a little bit more. One is that we haven't done as good a job at doing outreach to a more diverse group of men. And that just as the women's movement started with mostly, you know, middle-class white women,
yes,
there became a critique of the narrowness of this and how it wasn't expressing the needs of all women. They took that on and over time diversified that movement so that it is very racially diverse and sexual orientation diverse. Mm-hmm. And it's been slower, but inside of the movement that I use the term pro-feminist or anti-sexist, that it's been important that there are more men of color involved and in leadership positions, and also to recognize that it's a time where, for those of us who have been doing this work for a long time and are in this fourth quarter, seventh inning, that we look to younger men. So one of the issues, the last issue I think that I sent to play, the cover story is about an organization called Next Gen Men. It is, their name, you know, says it all. And I've gotten to know the executive director and a few people on their staff over the last couple of years, and they are exactly taking on for 2022 and beyond the issues that Men's Resource Center was taking on in the 80s and 90s. And just to say, the founding executive director of the Men's Resource Center, who I worked with closely, my dear friend Steve Botkin, when we first read about Next Gen Men, he said, "Oh, this reminds us of us in the early days." So,
wow.
So that short passing is going on, and they're working more closely with voicemail. And I think even though they're in Canada, where there's been a lot of great anti-sexist, pro-feminist men's work going on. So it's happening. And those of us who have this sphere of influence to bridge those divides and to bring more people in, whether it's, you know, getting clergy to talk about it from the pulpit or work with mentors in schools, to coaches, to really invite, because, you know, I'm pointing up the street, the high school here, there's a women's rights club that's been going on for 20 years. And we're not at the place where it's called the gender rights club, but every year if there's, you know, 25, 30 women, there's 5 or 6 or 7 guys. And that gives me hope when I see, you know, that that's what's happening.
Well, and to add on, the voicemail magazine is kind of the flag for some of this work. And it's voicemail, M-A-L-E, which I love. The point I wanted to make is this, this is not just a U.S. magazine. This it looks to me like it's taking in and speaking to more than just the young men in the U.S. Am I correct?
Yes. And I think one of the most exciting things that has happened is starting about 20 years ago, maybe a little bit more, those of us who had been involved in North America became aware that this work is actually global.
Yes.
There was a U.S.-born guy who is actually originally from Texas who was living in Brazil, and a colleague working in South Africa. They had the perspective that was not North America narrow perspective. They had a more global perspective. And they started about 20-some years ago an organization called Men Engage, all one word, Men Engage, with the E, the first E capitalized. And that's grown over the years, the Global Men Engage Alliance, to be in, I want to say, about 85 countries and hundreds and hundreds of organizational and individual members on 5 continents. And as soon as we and the Men's Resource Center, and as I was taking voicemail from a organizational newsletter and elevating it to a magazine, it became clear that, oh, we have to talk about what's going on globally. And some of the most exciting work was going on in South Africa and in India. And, you know, Europe was similar, and Scandinavia. I mean, Africa itself, there's probably 17 countries on the African continent that have Men Engaged chapters. So this is clearly a global movement. And it's all from the get-go, it has acknowledged as voicemail and the Men's Resource Center did, the leadership of women and the wanting to endorse and back the voices of women. So this is a movement to invite younger men into working for gender equality and for their own enlightenment and their own freeing of themselves. But it has been an inclusive movement that has been diverse across the board in race and class and gender.
I think I read there were over 900 organizations.
Yeah, I'm not keeping up with my own information.
You know, Rob, what I love about this is how much hope this gives me, because when the embers are just started, when we are just seeing the little bit before the fire really catches, and when we're doing, you know, when Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote the Hamilton, and he talked, and one of the songs is being in the room where it happened. This feels like we are in the room where it happened. That there is such a shift in consciousness that is happening right now that is actually what is emerging is something so much more integrated and so much more whole than where we have been before.
It's true. It's true that the first symposium of the Men Engage Alliance was in 2009 in Rio de Janeiro, and there are about 450 people from around the world. A few years later, in 2014, was the next symposium, and that happened in New Delhi, India. and that had 1,200 delegates from around the world. And it was the most thrilling thing. The workshops, the plenaries, everything was so sparkling, but there was a big courtyard. It was November, and the temperature is, you know, very late spring-like, around 70s. And at lunch or in the breaks, people would be outside, and you know, we had booths with our information, but it was like United Nations of people all rowing in the same direction. And it looked like the United Nations of the world. And, you know, there were many things that I learned in the plenaries and all of the workshops, but my heart lived in that courtyard for the breaks and for lunch and getting together with, you know, Julio from Mozambique and, you know, everyone. I mean, you can see the excitement is still there all these years later. We were all set, we as members, to go to Kigali in Rwanda last November, of last year, for the new symposium. But of course, COVID intervened. And talk about making lemonade out of lemons. Instead of a five-day experience with a finite, maybe it would have been up to 2,000 people, it was a series of plenaries and workshops that went on from November to June and allowed people from around the world. And you can go to the manengage.org, to their website, and just type in Kigali, the Manengage third symposium, and you can dip into workshops on every topic under the sun, and some from outer space, probably.
I'll be sure and put that URL in, because that's so important.
It is, and it's so exciting, Rob, to see. When you look at where you are today, and what are the things that you're investing in, the things that you're curious about, what's burning on the work that you're doing?
Well, I touched on it. It's that next gen man. It's literally those people from, you know, their 20s, 30s, 40s who are stepping into this work and who are ready to take on this work. I think that's one piece. And the other is figuring out how to loosen and open the hearts of men who have so much to offer in terms of mentoring and leadership, and expressing that the dialogue that we're hearing out there about men, you know, there's another voice.
Yes.
I mean, sadly, too many of the examples of masculine behaviors, quote unquote, are so negative. I'm not a fan of the term toxic masculinity, but I get it. I understand it. It kind of freeze frames, you know, we're not all, you know, in a moment, someone could be expressing toxic behavior, but that's not their whole identity. Yet the examples that we get, that we're bombarded with every day, I mean, you know, there's a madman operating in Moscow who's isolated, who is an example, you know, until a year ago, I mean, you know, who we could point to our own country and speak about that example. But I mean, he's still influential, but he's hopefully going to get more isolated and become old news. But all of these examples of the worst of you know, stuck, stubborn,
right,
fearful, tight, all of those examples, if we sit back and don't challenge them, then that becomes, that's why that term, you know, you're introducing, you know, a great new term. And may it, you know, take root and become more powerful and more in the daily parlance than toxic. You know, compassion wins every time.
It is a power. I love the way you framed that earlier, where you were talking about compassion being identified with the female, with the woman, rather than compassion and courage. Yet what you've said, Clay, so often, and we've had, is that courage. There is such courage in compassion.
Well, Brené Brown talks about courage and the root being cur, which means heart. And I keep going back to my time in college as a cadet at A&M, and as a freshman, they marched us over to the Memorial Student Center and say, "You memorize this Bible verse. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friend," John 15:13. Now, that's compassion. And there's nothing soft about that. When a man lays down his life for another man, you know, that's the supreme act of compassion. So these ideas that compassion is something soft is really not. It's really off base. It's much greater than that.
Yeah. You know, we've talked about some people describe the crisis in masculinity, and we're not hearing about the good news about, you know, compassionate men and men who are wanting to change. But if we want to see men change, and if we want to have a culture that's really inviting that change, then we have to be honest and open to identify situations where the danger is so acute and the lack of identification of what's going on is so understated. What do I mean by that? The January 6th insurrection. Okay, this was an information from my friend and colleague Jackson Capps. Was 93% white, but 86% male. Mm-hmm. And have you heard any discourse? Have you heard any commentary? Have you heard any attention being given to the gender of the insurrectionists? I've written commentaries over the years since Columbine about how maddening it is that we don't say the shooter's gender identity. Name a spot. 99% of the mass shootings, school shootings, theater shootings are done by men. And that we, at our peril, think of this as a mental health issue, which, of course, it is on some level. Even with this high school student and his out-of-control parents in Michigan, we don't speak the truth. And how are we going to change if we don't identify what the problem is? Yeah. So to me, if we want to take back the precious democracy that's in peril right now, one of the places is to identify who the insurrectionists primarily were. And I would say that, well, of course, everybody knows that they're men. I mean, you say that there was a mass shooting, and everybody's in their mind, the image is not of a woman. And of course, if it is a woman, then that's what the woman charged with mass shooting. But we don't identify the perpetrator. We take it for granted. So part of the work of getting to a place where we can all embrace the new compassionate male is by looking at the hurt, twisted, destructive, troubled, dangerous, existing expression of so-called manhood. And I think that that's a piece that in terms of what we need to be looking at right now as a culture, as a society, as a political moment, is really honing in on that disparity.
So well put. Thank you for that.
I one of the things I did in my days at the Men's Resource Center, we had a range of programs from a bunch of different kinds of support groups for men, young men of color leadership program, and a women's support group for women whose partners or ex-partners were in a batterers program. And we ran a certified batterers intervention program. So it was very broad range and published voicemail. We had a bunch of things going on with youth, with women, with batterers, with general support, a gay men support group, men who had been neglected or abused in some way growing up. But for many years, Wednesday nights, I would lead a group. And at a later point, we decided we should have co-leadership of a woman and a man running batterer intervention group. But one of our co-leaders coined this term, Steve Jefferson, who's now not here on the planet, a wonderful man. He coined the term compassionate confrontation. So imagine you're sitting in a room where men either have been ordered by the court to go through this 20-week program, 2 hours every week, or a spouse said, you either deal with this or I'm out of here, or a clergy member or a therapist. So there was a mix of court mandated and pushed and encouraged, and they'd sit there. And you could watch over the course of the groups, when they started, there would be such resistance, and there would be, unwilling to own any of the behaviors that got them there. And the beauty of the program was that people came in a staggered way. So somebody who's in week two, sitting in a room with someone at week 9 and someone at week 16, the vets would hone in, the group leader would sit back, dude, you are just completely bullshitting yourself. You are completely, not acknowledging the reality. She just fell, if she hadn't have done that, then I wouldn't have. And they broke it down. But Steve, when he coined this term, it's like, we know that you're not, a batterer 24/7. And so I'm going to feel the compassion for whatever it was in your life circumstances, however you were brought up, whatever happened to you, whatever bad things, I'm going to feel compassion for you. And simultaneous truth, I'm going to confront your abusive behavior. So going back to that model of how we ran the organization, supporting men, challenging men's violence, we could hold both parts of them.
Yes.
And just as a historical note, in the 80s and 90s, that was a radical notion within the batterers intervention world. And as time went on, the rest of that movement caught up with that vision, just because it became the truth that compassion is courage, exactly like you said.
God, Rob, that is so profound, because today to be able to hold two thoughts at the same time, and to be able to have, because I need to not only have compassion for what I see out in the world, but if I cannot have compassion for myself, for my mistakes, for what I've done, if I'm not able to express it to myself also, I'm not going to be able to be as effective in the outer world.
Exactly. There's a lot of fires burning out in the world, and among the ones that we have to take care of is the fire of of hate that's in our own hearts.
Yes. Yes, I have that. When you look at your grandchildren, what do you see? How do you see in their consciousnesses as they were growing up from when you were that age and you're getting a chance to do? What does that do?
I mean, that's another place where I feel a lot of hope. There are a girl and two sets of siblings, girl and a boy and two boys, and they're between almost 9 and down to 4. Particularly the older ones, 9 and 7, they have a natural sensitivity. One of them is copying out poems that he likes. One of them is, knitting one day and going to Taekwondo the next. I mean, they're integrated. They're integrated.
Yes.
And I think, and their parents are raising them to hold both places. Now, the culture, no question, the culture is going to still try to push them into those traditional boxes. But I think a lot of younger parents who are, it's not even that they're consciously fighting back. They're just, this is how I want to raise my kids.
I don't think, Rob, that the number has to be 50% to get to the tipping point. There's something about consciousness that takes a much smaller number to get to a tipping point to infect the entire society.
Yeah, I agree.
Isn't this wonderful, Clay? Can you just feel my emotions, my heart is opening so much to being around you, Rob?
I want to say this, and I'm saying this with all my heart, that last year with this podcast, we talked to great men, great women, and as I said earlier, they tend to be towards a little bit older. This year, I really want to bring in the youth. I really want to hear the voices of the young people because the audience needs to hear it, and I want them to have this platform.
I need
to
hear it.
And
I need to hear it. That's why we are in search of, Rob. We're in search of because we're exploring without and within us, because there are so many places that I have conscious and unconscious biases that I haven't even worked through, that I need to continue to work through, and both of us are exploring. That's why we are in search of and deliberately made it in that vein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they're out there and not at this moment, but I'm happy to give you some suggestions of men to invite. And I don't know, do you have women on this show?
Absolutely.
Demographic, Clay's done the demographic.
Yeah, that listen to the podcast and that visit the website consistently between 48% to 52% of the followers, of the people who go to visit the website or listen to the podcast, are women. There's been weeks that where it's more women than men on the podcast or listening to the podcast.
They want to believe it's possible. They want to believe that we can actually grow and change.
Yeah. And the voices of the women who've been on the podcast have been incredible.
Please.
Have been incredible.
Great.
We would love to, not only that, but we want to continue to connect with you, Rob, and your guidance in helping us to find the voices, because the voices that are around you are the voices we want to amplify.
Well, that's wonderful, and it just occurred to me that in addition to listeners or viewers on YouTube of the podcast, you might want to check voicemailmagazine.org and look at it online. And just remember, if you don't spell mail, M-A-L-E, you won't get too far. And if you don't put in magazine, you're going to find a wonderful men's a cappella group that does some great singing. I always thought they should do a benefit concert for us, but they're called Voicemail. But you have to write voicemail, M-A-L-E, magazine.org. But for those who are old school or who just like the tactile experience, I'd be happy to have us send a physical copy of the magazine to anybody, and they can, you know, have that as an offering from us.
Bob, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to learn with and from you, and to have this gracious moment. This is very holy for me. This gives me a great deal of inspiration and hope. And Clay, I know you.
Yeah. I'm almost speechless. I'm so excited.
That is something. Clay Boykin being speechless is written.
That's a mouthful, right?
I'm understanding from what you're both saying that we've reached the end of our time, and it's literally flown by, because you have both invited the conversation and woven it together. That just really allowed me to feel that sense of hope that, you know, men aren't just stuck, that men are opening up. I used to say that when I was giving a talk or something, that if the lights went out and there was no power, you know, I would just have three words to say: believe in men. Believe in our capacity to grow. Believe in our capacity to change. Yeah. And to feel a sense of hopefulness despite how many opportunities there might be to feel hopeless, because it's happening. It's happening, and we're only going to grow. And it's our time to speak up and to speak out.
Oh, Clay, thank you so much for inviting me, and Rob Oakham, thank you so much for joining me, and it is certainly for me not going to be the last time I'm going to be joining you, and we're going to be doing it. But anyway, thank you so much, and I thank all the listeners. Thanks, everyone, for supporting the podcast, supporting the vidcast, and Clay and I will get a chance. All the information is on the link, and we will see all of you in search of the new compassionate male next time.
Check out the latest episode of In Search of the New Compassionate Male on your favorite podcast station.